All right, so the first two questions. And yeah, let's start with Vicky. But who's number two? Who's number two? Person number two, has someone else has a question? Okay, way in the way back. And Gary's fixing the mic. Okay, Vicky.
I realized that there was something else I wanted to tell you, which is that out of doing that diet and writing the book, I thought, how can I spread this notion? So I created this thing called the 10-Day Local Food Challenge. It exists. It's localfoodchallenge.org. You can go on and get the instructions. For 10 days, you eat food within 100 miles of your home. That's huge. Giving yourself 10 exotics, foods from afar you can't live without. And there's a Facebook page, and you can tell your stories and such like that. So we ran it for a couple of years, and we had up to 1,000 people participating at one point, and then I let it go just to see, just to leave it be as something people can pick up. But one of the biggest insights people have, and I just give it to you, is they start ticking off their exotics. And they start to think, what can I not live without? And when you get, you can do 5 easily, 6 maybe, and you start to realize that, you know, it's not that hard to be a local eater in a living food system. You know, you don't need everything from the industrial system. You just need some things that are precious to you. And then you start thinking, okay, I can get my greens within 10 miles or 50 miles. I can get my grains maybe 100 miles. I could get my meat maybe 500 miles. You start to see that relocalizing our food systems is not rocket science. It's taking away the structures that are forcing us into an industrial system. Thank you very much, Vicky. That was the answer to your question.
Okay. Thank you, Vicky. I think the operative word there is possibilities. You know, what's possible, right? So the person in the back?
Yeah. Yes, this question is for Michael. So what was your... how did you get access to this land within the cities, and how did you raise funding for the infrastructure for the farms, and what was the whole process to start these urban farms?
Okay, can you hear me? Yeah. Well, it's a fairly big question. Read the book. first of all, you have to understand this was municipal codes do not address the kind of use that we were doing, certainly not on the scale that we're operating. So that was a major challenge. I was lucky because Gregor Robertson, who I've known, he's the mayor of Vancouver, well before he was mayor, he was an organic farmer. And the city manager who came to Vancouver from Chicago under Mayor Daley, as the Greens are in Chicago, were in a unanimous city council. So we had this kind of perfect storm. So we did get high-level support, but by the time it would trickle down through the vast bureaucracy, it was a major challenge. And, the building inspector who's looking at those 16,000 square feet of tunnel houses as we were constructing them and saying, well, where's the fire exits? You know, we can't permit this without fire exits. So I invited them out, and I had them go inside, and I just stuck my hand through the plastic and opened a door, an exit, you know? But this is the kind of craziness that exists. They have the intention to support this kind of thing. But so we've spent gazillions of dollars just in permitting and environmental consultants and all this stuff that we were required to do. Our project generates about $300,000 to $350,000 a year in gross income from products grown and sold. Our budget is closer to $700,000 a year, and that other $350,000 goes to supporting the social piece of the agenda. I had to accept after a few years we would never operate on the same playing field as any other farm because our staff were never going to work at the same rate, and there was a certain, you know, people don't always show up. They fall off the wagon. When they return, instead of the question being, where have you been, it's how are you doing, which is a difference. So we had to raise, though, a lot of money, a lot of capital to actually initiate it. And we formed a registered charity which owns the project. Soul Food Street Farms is wholly owned by a charity called Cultivate Canada, which I started. And, you know, so I have to go out, you know, begging and raising money. But it's when Queen's University did that study and determined for every dollar that we pay our staff, there's a $2.25 savings to the legal, healthcare, and social assistance systems. In other words, that we're doing the public work. I felt a lot better about it. I felt like, okay, I'm okay raising this money. I'm okay that this isn't going to act like every other farm and generate all of its income by the pound, you know. I don't know if that answers your question. I get into a lot of this. There's a lot of storytelling in the Street Farm book. There's a few out there if you want them. And so, yeah, it's the best I can do.
Thank you, Michael. Another question over here.
I think this question's for Michael, but maybe if anybody else has an answer. I've been thinking a lot about there are some people that have resources and some people that don't, and a lot of times these people never meet each other. And through a lot of these conventions, I've met a lot of really good-hearted people, but so this is one of the questions that comes up for me, the idea of local how do you, like you said, you had a pretty good life and all of this, but you felt compelled to maybe branch outside your community to bring some good outside your community, and then also you don't want to overstep, you don't want to, you know, so maybe like how have you navigated those spaces of, yeah, that's my question.
I've navigated those spaces by making every mistake in the world. I mean, you know, agriculture, as we know it, agriculture is the culmination of 7,000 years of trial and error, mostly error. And if you're not willing to make mistakes, and sometimes big mistakes, and sometimes expensive mistakes, and sometimes mistakes that are humiliating, then better to just not get out of bed, because, and I find now at 63, like if you read that book, it's more about where we fell short than where we succeeded. I'm very clear about that. This is not, we did not solve some problem. we're still trying, and we're, you know, every day is a question, you know. But I find that the mistakes and the failures are far more informative and helpful, not only to ourselves, but to the world, than those things that we have actually succeeded in. And I will say that in our case, we really are laser focused on the humanity piece of the project. You know, this is where I think we've had the most success. We are constantly having to remember, you know, it's not about the food, it's not about the sales of the food, it's not about the farming. That's just the foundation of something much deeper. And that we respect our staff. There is no, if you came to see what we do, you'd never sense any difference between the four managers of this entire project and the other 25 people who are working on it. It's an even playing field. And when you're out there in on a farm working, everyone is on an equal level. We don't, you know. So I think, I don't know, that didn't answer your question at all, did it? But that's why I should have been a politician or something. But sorry. I don't even know what your question was now. I think I'm tired.
So if we're talking about food, and not jobs or a dignified workplace, I just want to say some of the things that we're doing on Whidbey. Is number one, we have a food bank that's supported by the thrift store. So every time I do my clothing addiction, I'm supporting the food bank. And the other part of it is everybody in the community knows there but for fortune go I. There is no shame, none, at going to the food bank. Not only that, we have volunteers with one staff person who've done like 2 acres of gardens, so people who go to the food bank eat better than the rest of us. So there's like, I think that there's, at a community food system level, that there's ways that people can have access to food that doesn't make them undignified. We also have one church does Tuesdays and Thursdays, there's a lunch. And I first thought, I'm not destitute enough to go to the church lunch. But it turns out you can just donate whatever you want to donate. People love doing the cooking, and you get to sit down with people you never knew before. So it went from being a feeding program in my mind to being, oh, it's cool, it's Thursday, and it's 12:30. Oh, I could go over and have lunch. And, you know, I can pay $5 for it or whatever I want to pay. So, and they get, you know, some of they get all the cakes that haven't sold at the end of the day from the supermarket. They get all the bread that hasn't sold from the end of the day. They have great food. So I think that there's something about community values where you realize we're all in this together. Sometimes some of us have more and some of us have less. But if we're participating in a system that says, you know, we're going to joyfully feed one another, then it equalizes it. So it's not what Michael's talking about, but I just wanted to put that in, that there are ways that you can capture the flow of food through systems and make sure that your community eats. My fascination is with, can we retrofit communities of place to be the kinds of communities we envision? You know, these like mutuality, reciprocity, everybody gets cared for. Can we do that where we live? And so those are just some examples.
Thank you, Vicky. Did anyone else want to respond? Okay, so let's get two more questions. One over here and two back there.
So I'm aware of the time of the day, and that, Derek, your opening statement touched me. You've heard a lot of incredible things in being here. So I kind of want to ask this of the panel, but of the group as a whole. I'd love to hear from three voices as to what are you taking away from this conference that maybe you didn't come with, but is something that's germinating now in you. And it could be from the panel, it could be from somebody in the audience, but I'm suggesting three.
So anyone from the audience like to respond to that? What are you taking away? What's living in you right now, knowing it might change in the next 24, 48 hours, the next couple weeks, as you digest? Yes.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jonathan Perkins. I live here in town. And something that's living in me right now is an urgent need for... Well, before I say that, I just want to say thank you for everyone for sitting inside indoors during this beautiful sunny weather for this long, because it's really hard for me to do, and I understand that it would be hard for others. But a lot of what has been talked about here is connection, looking at the big picture in a different perspective, systemic practices, the whole shebang. And I feel like within that, there is a need to focus on our treatment of other earthlings within our food supply, within the way of our development and expansion, within just the basic core of our morals and ethics, and in wanting to reconnect with Mother Nature, and that being this paradigm shift currently, today, that is so necessary. We need to value her children more than we are outside of our own species. And it's imperative to do that in order to make any rights out of any wrongs and evolve further into actually living in harmony and in balance and towards the goal that we want to move towards. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Someone else? Anyone else like to respond to that question, either on the panel or in the audience? Sometimes it's hard to speak when there's been so much input. Over here?
Michael, this question is for you. How did you get around the gentrification of the downtown east side? And are you planning to do anything with the with Chinatown?
Yeah, well, when we started 8+ years ago, there were a number of potential sites available for us. And now we have to move our main headquarters site, which is a 2.5-acre site. And I can tell you, it was a real difficult thing to find a single place to move. We have to stay within the community that we work with, obviously. And so we've seen the impact of the real estate boom, if you, I call it other things, but that's the polite term. And it's not just on housing, it's on opportunities in many respects. I don't know, I mean, the future of the project, like our work, our project, our farms are as homeless as some of the people that we employ. We have a moving system. The system was designed to be movable. Those boxes have forklift tabs and stackable, nestable. There was a lot of thinking in that. But we would like to have a permanent location. There will be a new park that's going in, and we've been trying to see if we could have 2 acres within that new park. It's a big dream because everybody wants sports fields and big expanses of grass. And so, no, the extension of Creekside Park, actually, which is where we'd like to be. But, yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I do not have personally have any answers, at least ones that I can express publicly, about the gentrification of the downtown east side. And that's a much longer conversation. I do have opinions and thoughts about what could happen there, but, you know, so, yeah, thank you. And I hope we can have some questions for the rest of the panel here, so.
Yes, is there a question over here?
I'll go ahead. My name is Paul. And I've, for a long time, been on the board of an organization in St. Paul, Minnesota, called the Jefferson Center. And the project there, I think, might be of interest. It's called the Rural Climate Dialogues. They've been doing for the last year or two, going into farming communities and bringing maybe 20 farmers from the community together with facilitation and information and saying, how's the weather? And they got 2 days to talk about that. And these are people intentionally drawn from all sides of the political spectrum. And when you ask them that question, all of a sudden, all the diverse subsections of climate change fall away, and they start having real conversations about what is our local community going to do as the darn weather's changing and the way we farm is changing. And I wanted to ask what you thought would happen if you brought together a bunch of local farmers and say, well, what's new and what should we do about it? Maybe that is what you're doing already.
Part of what one of the projects I mentioned, Front and Centered, is doing that not with farmers, but just with communities across Washington State. So our membership is made up of, in part, indigenous communities, in part, African American communities, Latino communities. So each of them this summer actually went out across the state and held listening sessions on questions of where do they see climate change in their community manifesting. So we're compiling all that into a kind of a report looking at the disproportionate impacts of climate change and how communities of color are specifically impacted. So a different community, but a similar process. I do think that listening is so important. So,
two very quick things. One, I just want to say that the smaller regional diverse farms are inherently more resilient to climate change. But also, in the book, there's a whole urban food or food manifesto. And actually, I end it by saying that I believe that the most important role that farmers play in the future is not the production of food, but the sequestering of water and carbon. We have we have all this land, and if we apply ourselves to that element, we have enormous power in terms of positive power in terms of climate. And there's some really good work being done on how to enhance that. We're not just talking about long fallow pastures. There's some more active ways of increasing our ability to sequester carbon in particular, but water as well. So.
Okay, thank you, Michael, Brandy, Derek, Vicki. Really appreciate your offerings.
Can I take a closing? I think to back to your question of what is the takeaway, just to sort of create a bit of a wrap, I invite us all to notice as the flow of these couple days together is hit on some of the greatest challenges and obviously then just exemplified project after project and person after person and possibility after possibility that's trying to bring response to that. But what I really heard in this last piece was to risk it big, to color outside of the lines, to take the complex and integrate, and to go where angels fear to tread. So I would feed that back to us all as what's our takeaway from this, and I hope that has multiplier effects.
And so it shall be. Thank you so much. So we'll have Karen here to close the conference here for us. Karen?
I'm Karen Wyeth, the main organizer for this conference, but it was was actually a very big collaborative effort with many, many people involved. And so I have a very long list of people to thank. I want you to notice that this is what community looks like. When I first started this process of organizing this conference, I thought I could do it all by myself, and a couple of months into it, I realized I was in way over my head. So I turned to my community and asked for help, and they jumped on board by the dozens. So I'm very impressed with the people that I live with and the people that came from far afield to help as well. So there's so many people to thank. Helena had to jump on a plane to go to her next event, so she's not here, but I really want to thank her and the work that she does with Local Futures and for all of her guidance in helping me put this conference together, and as well as her staff at Local Futures. I want to thank Local 2020, which is our main partner organization, for all of their assistance, especially Judy Alexander, who was my right-hand man and was with me right from the beginning. And I'd like to thank all of the partner organizations that worked with us to help promote the conference and for all of their support. I'd like to thank Lonnie Greninger, who opened this conference with a song and some very wise words for someone so young. And I would like to deeply thank all of the speakers and workshop presenters for generously sharing their time, their expertise, and their heart with all of us. I would like to give a round of applause to those that are still here with us. I'd like to thank our musicians, Larkin Stentz, who was our flute player, and Lawrence Cole for leading us in joyful song. All of our talented actors from Poetic Justice Theater Ensemble. I think there are a few of them around. Our tour guides, Abba Kaiser, Matt Reddy, Fran and Dan Post, Beth Odell, Finn River Farm, and Lawrence, Indiana. And to all my registration angels, Amy Poteet, Catherine Millman, Sonia Hammer, Terry DeBow, Bev Stoll, and Peggy Sisko. David Seabrook, who generously offered his time to chauffeur our speakers to and from the airport. Jeanette Martins for the beautiful flower arrangements. Perry Spring and Gary Engbrecht, I hope I said that right, for all of their technical support, and Mark Cooper. Bob Simmons for making all my signage. And my daughters, Rachel and Allison, who tied hundreds of strings onto hundreds of tags. And last but not least, my ever-patient husband, who had to listen to every single small detail of this conference for the last 10 months. And also, he was the site manager for this conference. And I also want to thank all of you for coming. And I believe that every person in this room is some sort of activist. So thank you for all the work that you do. And like Lonnie said at the very beginning of this weekend, now it is up to us to take this knowledge and inspiration out into the world and share it with others. So again, thank you so much for coming, and have a safe journey home. But before we go, we'd like to have one final closing song with Lawrence Cole.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, there is... This is the economics of happiness, which is how do we find, in the face of all that is, this has been a great exploration in looking at the what kind of peril we're in and how we seem to be locked into this industrial growth economy, as Joanna Macy calls it, and all the ills that it spawns, and how do we keep ourselves to a level of attunement with the possibility for joy and happiness and keep the vision clear. So this is a song that came from a essay called By Their Fruits Ye Shall Know Them by Charles Eisenstein, and he's the author of the book The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. And he says, and to actually get up to the joy you hustle, you can only get up to the joy to the degree that you're willing to go down deep and actually feel the anguish and feel and apprehend the illness. And that the degree to which we have that courage, which we did a lot of that this time. And we've also had some really joyous and hopeful times as well. Because the next thing he says is, the illness seeks the medicine. So you have to wrap your full consciousness, no denial, and this has been a beautiful truth-telling time. The illness seeks the medicine. They can't come together without clear-sightedness around that. And then he's saying that he goes to these gatherings where there are young people who are living in this new paradigm and know that we're going to be able to do this. So this is what the nature of this song is. The bottom part goes, you want to get up to the joy, you got to go down deep. So go down, go down, go down. You want to get up to the joy, you got to go down deep. So go down, go down, go down. You want to get up to the joy, you got to go down deep. So go down, go down, go down. So if, then the next part. The illness seeks the medicine. So go down. The illness seeks the medicine, so go down. I'll tell you the third part goes, we can do this, we will rise. We can do this, we will rise. So let's stand up. And then we're going to put all three parts together, and You can even come closer so you can really hear each other if you want to. And here we go. You want to get up to the joint, got to go down deep. So go down, go down, go down. You want to get up to the joint, got to go down deep. So go down, go down.